When the historian's ideological bias distorts or ignores evidence from the past, a bad kind of revisionism emerges.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
It masquerades as honest history. Such revisionism needs to be exposed and dismantled. It undermines proper understanding of our world. It has been said those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In this case, failure to expose bad revisionism means that those who do not know the past are condemned to suffer at the hands of biased ideologues who claim they do.
You can meet and hear Dr. Mark Kaltoff making the case against revisionist history at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Basically, the trick is this. It's that if we can't explain something divine, it's not real. And if we can't explain it, therefore it's not divine.
But the problem for us is the Mormon Church denies or distorts a lot of these basic teachings that have always made Christians what they are.
The sole infallible norm of all things is Scripture itself. Why? Because Scripture itself is the voice of God, whereas tradition doesn't occupy that exact same kind of role within the church.
This is John in Michigan, and as a Lutheran high school teacher, I love listening to and using Issues Etc. in my classroom.
There are certain ideas, presuppositions that underpin our system of government here in the United States. We find them either explicitly stated or kind of laid out in the structure of the U.S. Constitution. No man is above the law. The separation of powers, checks and balances, the consent of the governed, self-government, that entire idea of self-government. Where did these ideas come from? Were they simply hatched when the U.S. Constitution was written, or did they come from someplace else? Where did the framers come by the ideas that make up the U.S. Constitution? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, August the 31st. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution today, the influences on the American founding. Dr. Russell Dawn will be our guest. First question to answer there is, why should Christians care about what's in the Constitution and whether they rightly understand it? A little bit later in the program, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Chris Roseborough this week in Pop Christianity. We're going to talk about televangelist Jensen Franklin's message, Beware the Traveler. Then we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour of the program. We have four soundbites to play for you. All you have to do is listen. And after you've listened to the four soundbites near the end of the program, you give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and you vote for one of those to be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We're beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution today. We're going to talk about the influences on the American founding. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought. He's director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Why do Christians in America need to understand and know something about the U.S. Constitution?
Well, in terms of salvation, they really don't need to. This is a left-hand kingdom matter, as it were. It is something that has to do mainly with our earthly lives. So that's a fair question you're asking. Why then do we care? But really, why then do we care about anything in the earthly realm? And it's because good governance, in this case, it's because good governance is a gift from God. The earthly realm consists of many good gifts from God for us. So the Constitution is important because it provided, and still to a great extent provides, good governance for us in America, and that's a gift from God in the earthly realm. Also, good governance is a useful support for the right-hand realm, in other words, for the realm of the church and salvation, because without good governance, without freedom of religion, it can become far more difficult and even dangerous to worship the one true God.
I think it was sometime last year we were speaking to a regular guest here on the program, former U.S. Attorney Ed Meese, Attorney General, and he had noted a similarity between the way people handle the U.S. Constitution and the way they handle the Bible. He just noticed the similarity that liberal Bible scholars tend to view the Bible as kind of a living, waxen document, and liberal constitutional scholars tend to view the Constitution the same way. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I would agree 100%. And that's because really the way liberal scholars treat these texts is symptomatic of their worldview, rather than these being sort of accidental or coincidental that, oh, well, they happen to treat this text the same way they treat that text. It actually comes from aspects of their worldview, which tend to deconstruct, tend to downplay the importance of the author and the author's meaning in a text, and tend to play up the importance of the meaning imputed to a document by whoever is reading it. And of course, in the case of these liberal scholars, they're the ones doing the reading, and they're wanting these texts to cohere with the scholar's own worldview and the scholar's own view of right and wrong, of how things ought to be. And so when the Bible or the Constitution don't match up with the progressive worldview, then it's easy for them to apply their hermeneutic, to apply their way of interpreting the text loosely so that the text can magically come to agree with their liberal worldview.
Were the ideas that we find embedded in and expressed and the kind of acting as presuppositions for the U.S. Constitution, were those ideas at the time of its conception new ideas?
In large part, no. In fact, in vast majority part, no. These were not really new ideas. This was more the Constitution was more a culmination of ideas that were perhaps only a century or so old at the time of the writing of the Constitution, all the way back to ideas that were 2,000 years old. And most of them were more on the older side rather than the newer side.
So let's talk about some of the influences on the American founding as a general context for understanding the Constitution, beginning with probably the system most familiar to those who were constructing the new world and this new system of government, the one that they had left in England. How would you begin?
Yes. Well, there's a great heritage of liberty and order and good governance, actually, in the English heritage. Now, the good governance was suffering mightily at the time of the Revolution, which is why the Revolution took place. So there was much that needed to be rejected, but there was a lot in terms of old tradition that the founders saw every reason to bring into the new system. So perhaps the best place to start with this is the idea of higher law. And higher law is, there's no magic to that term. It's a term used by legal scholars, and in particular it was used notably well by a scholar in the early part of the 20th century by the name of Edward Corwin. The higher law is really just natural law that is binding upon everyone, rulers and ruled alike. So natural law is a very old idea, goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks that we know of. Certainly the ancient Romans adopted these ideas from the Greeks. But, you know, these are just broad ideas of right and wrong that apply everywhere and always and to everyone. So, for instance, we should seek the good and shun evil. This is very basic, fundamental natural law, that it is in the nature of things that people should seek good and shun evil. And there are other ideas that philosophers have attributed to natural law ideas. And so the ancients, the Greeks and the Romans in particular, loved to use natural law as a way of explaining how excellent their existing laws were. Look how great the laws of this Roman Republic are, they fit perfectly with the nature of things, with human nature, with the nature of the world around us. And so it was a mechanism for boasting in a way. But things deteriorated as time went on. The Roman Republic fell and became the Roman Empire. And then after the Roman Empire fell in the 5th century, power in Europe in medieval times became very personal rather than mixed and dispersed among a variety of individuals. Power became lodged, if you will, in a person, and therefore irresponsible. Power became irresponsible. It wasn't responsible to an equally powerful other party. So by the late Middle Ages, there developed an idea of natural law as a necessary limit on unjust laws, as so many unjust laws had been perpetuated by these irresponsible powers. Philosophers began to develop ideas of how natural law can be used to limit the powers of the sovereign. And so that's kind of the idea of higher law. Natural law is higher than the highest individual sovereign. Now, this idea of higher law didn't have very much influence on the continent of Europe for many centuries. So a great example of this is Louis XIV of France, nicknamed the Sun King. And he ruled in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, and he continued this irresponsible power. There were very few checks on his power, and those that existed were not very effective. But in England, starting somewhere in the 1100s and developing gradually, you could say haltingly or unevenly, this idea of higher law took hold and began to control and limit the powers of the sovereign.
So another element here that we probably should talk about is the notion of individual liberty. Obviously, liberty is going to be more than just simply individuals, but where did this notion of individual liberty, as far as the founders and the framers of the U.S. Constitution, originate?
That's a great point. Without individual liberty, America looks very different from the way that it does. Really, individual liberty can be traced back to the Magna Carta in England in 1215, and really farther than that. But in terms of the way the founders were thinking, they would certainly have pointed back and did point back to the Magna Carta and adopted many of the ideas that are enshrined in that document. So, for instance, the Magna Carta, going all the way back to 1215, promised a trial by jury. Now, that promise was not for everyone. Let's be clear about that. Individual liberty was for certain individuals, not necessarily for all individuals in England. So the nobility certainly had individual liberty, and in many cases, free men who were not of the noble class had individual liberties. For the most part, serfs and women did not have the sorts of freedoms we're talking about here, but trial by jury. And in fact, the terminology was a jury of one's peers. And so when we think of that today, we think peers is just other people, other Americans. But in those days, a jury of peers meant a jury of other nobles, a jury of those of the same class. Also, the idea of no taxation without consent. This is the great rallying cry of the Revolution, but it's by no means a new idea in the time of the Revolution. That's why it was such a powerful motivator for the colonists, is this was a very ancient right for English people. It goes back at least to 1215 and probably farther back, because the Magna Carta was really just enshrining rights that the king at the time, King John, had begun to infringe upon. And then another example is that, and this one applied to all Englishmen, not just freemen and nobles, was that justice could not be denied or delayed. So these are examples of individual liberties that are part of what made the context for the American Revolution and the American Constitution make sense. They were accustomed to these ideas.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. We're beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution on this Friday, August the 31st. Talk about the influences on the American founding. When we come back, an often misunderstood idea, common law.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/HR.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Let's face it, no matter how hard you try to squeeze everything in, there are never enough hours in the day. If this struggle sounds familiar, you won't want to miss the September issue of The Lutheran Witness on time and limitations. With contributions from Jonathan Fisk, Brian Katchelmeyer, and others, this issue of the magazine will help you gain a heart of wisdom as you learn to number your days. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Issues Etc. returned to the air on June 30th after being canceled by the previous leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod during Holy Week of 2008. For a special 10-year anniversary donation of $100 or more, we'll send you a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. You can make an anniversary gift online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution, talking about the influences on the American founding with Dr. Russell Dawn. He is director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. Making the case for our first freedoms will be the subject for Dr. Ryan Anderson's presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Today, August 31st, is your last day to take advantage of the early bird registration fee of $110. Registration includes three meals. Attendance is limited to 400. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Dr. Dawn, what is this often misunderstood idea of common law?
Great question. Common law is very much misunderstood in the American system, even I think in American law schools. When I was in law school, I was taught that common law is simply judge-made law. And that's an understandable error, frankly, because that's pretty much what it has been reduced to in the American system. But originally, common law was not so much thought of as being made by judges, but rather being found by judges. So in the 12th century, King Henry II established a system of local courts around the kingdom with a central court of appeals. And so local laws that were seen as being based in right reason were made national, or you could say common, throughout the kingdom through this central court. But the idea wasn't that the judges in the central court were making these laws. Rather, they were recognizing the wisdom and the rightness, the reasonableness of laws that existed in certain localities. And because they were in accord with right reason, they should be made common throughout the kingdom. And that idea of common law was extremely powerful and important for liberty in England across the centuries. And then that's not to say that England had great liberty all across those centuries. Of course, the Tudor monarchs, for instance, were no friends of liberty. but the ideas are there. They exercised influence, greater at some times, lesser at other times, but ultimately emerging and flowering by the time we get to the American founding.
Another concept that you say has its roots in the English system for the framers of the U.S. Constitution is judicial review. What is that?
Judicial review is an underappreciated aspect of American liberty and American justice, I believe, and I'm certainly not the only one who believes that. The idea goes back mainly to a jurist by the name of Sir Edward Coke. He's an early 17th century English jurist. And he held, and it does go back farther than that, but he was an early powerful influence, if you will, in the emergence of judicial review. So if a legislative body makes a law and there's no one to review that law, no one independent of that legislative body to review whether that law is equitable, whether that law accords with right reason, with the natural law, then there's really nothing to help the people. There's nothing to prevent injustice. One can wax eloquent all day long about natural law, but if there's no one there to ensure that the legislators are actually carrying that out and putting it into the laws, then, as I said, the people really aren't helped. So this Sir Edward Coke held that if an act of Parliament, and this was in 1610, he ruled in a court case that if an act of Parliament is contrary to common right and reason, the common law will overturn that act of Parliament. The problem was, at the time, there wasn't a clear mechanism or institutional authority to make that happen. So Sir Edward said that it really should be the courts that do this, but it wasn't clear whether he was meaning the lower courts, and ultimately he did say that lower courts, local courts, could rule against an act of Parliament if it's contrary to common right and reason. But he ended up having to back off of that position because it was just too radical at the time that the highest lawmaker in the land, Parliament, the highest court of the king, as it was sometimes called by the king, could have their law overturned by a local judge was just anathema. The England wasn't quite ready for that yet. So really, true judicial review was yet in the future at the time of Sir Edward Coke. However, the idea was there, and he was really just pronouncing on something that was already hundreds of years old, and at least in theory among the philosophers. And so that idea of judicial review, that an unjust law could be struck down by an independent body, percolated and gained some ascendancy and eventually became a fundamental part of the U.S. Constitution.
I'm seeing some kind of broader concepts here, or more general concepts or presuppositions that I want to talk about a little bit with you in the England influence on the U.S. Constitution. One is very basic, that no man is above the law. Is that kind of one of the operating principles?
Yes, absolutely. That was a controversial matter, to be sure, in the time of the Tudors and Stuarts. In fact, you could say it all but disappeared. So that would be in the 16th and early 17th centuries. There were many monarchs who ruled as though they were above the law. So certainly King Henry VIII is famous for doing so. Less famously, Elizabeth I, near the end of the 16th century, in many ways attempted to rule as though above the law. Now, she was a much better monarch than King Henry was, but still, her power was somewhat irresponsible, meaning she really didn't answer to anyone. And then this became a point that was stated explicitly by King James I. He actually said it before he took the throne of England, and he was king in Scotland in the 1590s. But then he adopted it when he took the English throne in 1603. And he said explicitly that the king is above the law. And then his son, Charles I, who took the throne in 1625, he took that theory very much to heart and was among the most irresponsible leaders of England over the previous 150 years. And it ultimately ended up costing him his head in the English Civil Wars in 1649. He was beheaded.
Another concept that I see coming through those aspects that we discussed was the separation of powers that seems to be, in some cases, presupposed.
Yes, that is really one of the great, almost accidental circumstances of English government. It's an ancient concept. The Greeks espoused mixed government. The Greek historian Polybius loved the Roman system because of its separation of powers. When I say the Roman system, the Roman Republic, basically before Caesar Augustus. So he loved the idea of mixed government, and that notion of the superiority of taking a bit of monarchy and a bit of aristocracy and a bit of democracy and mixing them all together, that this would be a wise and fruitful form of government, that idea really did take hold in England. And it took some hits during the 16th and early 17th centuries in England. But before that, really, the eventual creation of Parliament was this balance of power, if you will. It was a mixing of government. And it came about because the nobles did have power vis-a-vis the king. This is what the Magna Carta recognized, that the nobles sort of forced King John to sign the Magna Carta because they had the power to do so. And then eventually out of this comes Parliament as a counterbalancing authority vis-a-vis the monarch. And so here, separation of powers, mixed government is formed in England and ultimately ends up carrying the day by the time we get to the end of the 17th century.
We would call this checks and balances, which is what the U.S. Constitution kind of, it's the juggling act that is the U.S. Constitution and the way that it's applied in government. In England's form of separated powers, did they conceive of it in that robust way as checking and balancing the various branches of government?
Well, at times, yes, never in as robust of a way as the founders of the U.S. Constitution, as the drafters of the U.S. Constitution would put in place. But the nobles were very much saw their role as a check on the power of the crown. And when Parliament came into being, that was the role of Parliament, to ensure that the king was not taxing the nobles without the consent of the nobles. And so that is a check on power. Again, this suffers greatly under the Tudors and the early Stuarts, but it regains old vigor and actually takes on greater vigor than it ever had after the Glorious Revolution, which was 1688-1689 in England. And by that point, you really have Parliament as arguably a greater power than the crown. Now, it didn't really look that way for quite some time after that, but ultimately the foundation was laid, the seeds were sown for Parliament to be superior over the monarch. But it wasn't really until the U.S. Constitution that this idea of checks and balances, not just power being separated, but power being a check to power, it was the U.S. Constitution that formalized that and secured it in a way that was so effective for so long. I think it's far less effective now, but we're jumping ahead a few weeks of the series.
Dr. Russell Don is our guest. We are beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution with him today, the influences on the American founding. When we come back, there are two kind of shadows of ideas back there in the British influence, consent of the governed and self-government. We'll talk about those after this.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Duluth, Minnesota would like to invite you to join us Sunday mornings at 9:30. Whether you are visiting our beautiful city or live here, we have liturgical worship that shares Jesus with you. We're easy to find at 20th Avenue East and Superior Street, and also offer Bible classes at 8:25 Sunday mornings with Sunday school September through May. Check out our website for other Bible study times, visit or call 218-724-2500.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300: Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York; Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama; Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California; St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan; Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado; Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri; the Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California; St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin; and St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org and click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our series on the U.S. Constitution begins with a conversation on the influences on the American founding. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. As I listen to you describe these basic ideas, another two seem to be less well-formed, barely formed, in the British influence. The first one is the consent of the governed. And then, maybe even less formed than that, is the idea of self-government.
Yes. Those ideas, again, are ancient. Self-government and basically the sovereignty of the people. That goes back to the Roman Republic. But the idea of the people, those who are actually sovereign, which was a much more limited idea in ancient times. And that was true in England as well. So, yes, there is some notion of popular sovereignty, of self-government by the people. But who are those people? Well, they're the people who aren't serfs. They're the people who are free. So that would be specifically men and generally, men of a certain social class in a very rigid class system. In addition to the limits on which people have any sovereignty, with a crown, with a monarch, and especially as powerful as the monarch was before the Glorious Revolution in the 1680s, really the crown was viewed as the sovereign. The people were subjects. So self-rule, self-government was only a nascent concept, only an emergent concept, and was embodied almost completely by the parliament. So sovereignty was still in the crown. Parliament was the voice of the people as sort of a counterbalance to sovereignty rather than a voice of sovereignty. But again, the idea is there in germ form, if you will, or in seed form, and will ultimately flower in the U.S. Constitution. It just, it takes these things time. They don't come up overnight.
One more question on England's influence before we move on to something you've mentioned here several times, and that's the Roman Republic. Were the framers of the U.S. Constitution, were they rejecting a constitutional monarchy? That's essentially what you have in England at the time. Were they rejecting that per se, or merely the abuse of that system by the current monarch, the tyranny that they often so speak of in the Declaration of Independence?
Ah, yes. Well, at the time of the Revolution, so a dozen, at the beginning of the Revolution, we're 13 years or a dozen years ahead of the Constitution. Really, it wasn't necessarily constitutional monarchy that was being rejected. Some were rejecting that. Certainly, Thomas Paine, who wasn't a citizen of one of the colonies, he was an Englishman who came and visited the colonies and was an influential writer there around the time of the Revolution. He was rejecting constitutional monarchy. He thought it was a silly idea and made no sense whatsoever. But not everyone was rejecting the idea. They were rejecting that power was being abused, that their locally elected legislatures, assemblies, if you will, were not allowed to exercise power, that power was being exercised from this distant legislative body of parliament, that they didn't recognize as having authority over their individual colonies. Now, as time went on, the idea of a king became abhorrent to the new nation, to the members of the new nation, no longer colonists, but citizens of the various states. But that wasn't necessarily the original thought.
Let's talk about the Roman Republic, because you have mentioned it several times here, and it is quite obvious that the whole idea of republicanism comes from the ancient Romans. Introduce us to that concept.
Okay. Rome began as a monarchy, but it wasn't a terribly long time before it developed into a republic with mixed government. They had consuls, two consuls. They had a Senate, and they had an assembly of the people. This was not direct democracy like in ancient Athens. It was this mixed representative government. And this was something that the founders of the United States admired greatly. It lasted a very long time, from the 500s BC until just shortly before the birth of Christ. And for a lot of that time, it was very effective. It was effective in terms of justice for many people. Now, it wasn't justice for all people by any stretch. There were slaves in ancient Rome, and as the Roman Republic grew and took over other places, the people that were taken over by Rome didn't necessarily have rights equal to citizens of Rome. So it was a limited good. But it was really an amazingly good step, given how ancient it was.
Talk about also the aspect of public virtue as necessary to that system of government. What was the idea of public virtue?
Thank you for bringing that up. That's really the moral foundation, if you will, upon which the success of the Roman Republic rested. And frankly, I believe it is the moral foundation of any successful society, that there is a sense of public virtue, which the way the Romans conceived of it was that people, the people who were free, had public virtues, meaning a sense of duty to the republic itself, and a sense of courage. And the culture, as long as that held fast in the culture, the Roman Republic could flourish, placing the good of the republic above the good of the individual. Now, this wasn't to say that they completely rejected the idea of an individual, or that the individual had no importance in ancient Rome, in the Roman Republic, but rather that these individuals would place the good of the public over their own good. So Cicero is one of the famous speakers on this, one of the famous orators, and in the Roman Republic in first century, near the end of the Roman Republic, first century BC. And he talks at length about how important the moral development of the individual is, the development of virtue. And virtue comes from a word meaning strength. So think of moral strength, having a backbone, having strong moral fiber and a compass and the will to do what is right in spite of opposition, in spite of the damage it might do to oneself, the injury that one might incur, either in terms of reputation or worse, if one goes forward in virtue, goes forward and does the right thing. Well, when one has developed that individual virtue, that personal virtue, then exercising it for the good of the whole, for the good of the republic, was necessary to actually having that virtue. You don't really have the virtue if you're unwilling to exercise it for the public good. So Cicero is a famously great orator, in part because he was simply a great orator, but also in part because he was speaking out for the preservation of the thing that really was necessary to the sustaining of the republic. Unfortunately, he was too little, too late. It wasn't long after that Augustus came to power.
Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. He's director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. We're beginning a series on the U.S. Constitution, talking about the influences on the American founding. When we come back, that public virtue, would we call it public-mindedness today? We'll find out.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love the truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Based upon human dignity, the nature of a human person, that we protect certain human rights.
Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And then amongst these human rights, the very first one is going to be the right to life, and then the right to liberty, especially religious liberty, and then how freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly and association, how these things actually hang together or they fall together. That a society that doesn't respect the free exercise of religion also will tend not to respect freedom of speech or freedom of press or the right to life or rights of private property, that these civil liberties tend to hang together.
You can meet and hear Ryan Anderson making the case for our first freedoms at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. We're starting a series on the U.S. Constitution, beginning by talking about the influences on the American founding. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with Pastor Chris Roseborough, our weekly feature with him, This Week in Pop Christianity. We'll talk about televangelist Jensen Franklin's message about Beware the Traveler. I don't know what it means. We will find out when Chris comes on. Then we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Dr. Dunn, before the break, you were talking about public virtue in the Roman Republic. In particular, how Cicero was calling for this foundational characteristic. Would we call that public-mindedness today?
Sure. That's a fair way of putting it. But it isn't, I think what we lack now, on the whole, and certainly not everyone, by any stretch of the imagination, but many people in America who have a public-mindedness don't necessarily take it in a way that grasps this idea of virtue, this idea of strength of character. So one can have public-mindedness and really do nothing better than protest and cause problems because the person doesn't happen to believe in this or that policy or practice going on in public. Whereas there's a self-sacrificial component to virtue that one is not just public-minded, but that one is willing to sacrifice oneself, sacrifice one's fame, fortune, etc., for the sake of this public good. So when the founders of the United States pledged their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor, I can't believe I don't remember the exact words, for the sake of the revolution, for the sake of creating this good society, or really recreating this good society, because it very much was a good society before the French and Indian War, that was capturing this old Roman idea of virtue. We are not doing this selfishly to pad our own pockets, to aggrandize our own power. We're actually willing to potentially lose all of our wealth and power for the sake of restoring our freedom as a people.
How did the framers of the U.S. Constitution, obviously they sought this kind of moral virtue and pursued it in themselves in order to accomplish what they wanted to. The framers were also the men who had to go out there and actually occupy these positions of government, and many, many of them already did or very quickly would. But how did they understand that public virtue in terms of, would the U.S. Constitution for them be such a structure so as to foster public virtue, or did it simply presuppose that public virtue in order to work? That would seem really risky venture to do. Did they believe that it would foster public virtue?
Yes. This is actually a controversial point you're bringing up. Not all scholars agree about whether the Constitution was designed to promote public virtue. It certainly rested on a presupposition of public virtue, that when the Constitution was drafted and then eventually adopted, that was one of the great points, is this is a system of government for a virtuous people. It is not suited to any other type of people. But your point about whether it actually created a situation where virtue, public virtue, could be fostered, that's a controversial point. I come down with a superior scholar than I am by the name of Thomas West. I come down with him on this, in that it did so really more indirectly rather than directly. The idea wasn't that the federal government, the national government, the central government would promote virtue, but rather this national or as we know it, the federal government would create the context in which the states could promote public virtue, and they could do so through education and through local institutions, local non-governmental institutions, by allowing those to flourish. Those would be things like churches and charities, which were mostly run by churches anyway. And so really the idea was that the federal government, which just means government by agreement among the states, would not be too powerful, would not be this great central power, but rather it was enough of a central power that it would create the context where the states themselves could be powerful and could promote the public virtue.
What stands out to me in the course of our conversation here so far, just beginning this series, we often think of the U.S. Constitution as merely a structure, a description of a structure of government. But what stands out to me is that it is also an expression of some very deep philosophical ideas. What are your thoughts there, finally, Dr. Dawn?
Absolutely. That's good insight, Todd, because this is something that is lost on so many people who talk about governing structures. I grew up with the notion that, well, the American system isn't perfect, but it's the best one in the world. But if we were to scratch the surface of that, there really wasn't much in the way of answers among ordinary folks I was around. There just wasn't much in the way of answers in terms of what makes it so great. Well, it disperses power. we have a judiciary that recognizes the rights of the individual and the person who is accused and things like that. And so, yes, it went into some of the structural components. But what you're bringing up is of vastly greater importance, which is the philosophy behind it, the worldview underneath all of this. And frankly, every structure of government has worldview underneath it. And so these notions of what is human nature? Is there a God? What is the relationship between humans and God? What is the relationship between humans and law? Is there natural law out there to be found? All of these are philosophical matters, and one's answers to these questions will determine the sort of government that one thinks is most beneficial, most suitable to a society. And so the founders of America were not all Christians. Many of them were Christians, but they all had, at least loosely speaking, what could be called a Christian or at least a natural law worldview. And that worldview or that philosophy formed the foundation for our Constitution and therefore the flourishing of America.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, look forward to our next conversation. Thank you very much for getting us started off in such a positive direction.
Well, I appreciate it, Todd, and I look forward to it as well.
When we come back, it's This Week in Pop Christianity, televangelist Jensen Franklin's message of Beware the Traveler. Pastor Chris Roseborough will be our guest.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We are what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.